all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, and I have the privilege of being your host today. I was the Chief Warrant Officer Helicopter Pilot in the United States Army in Vietnam in 1969. So that kind of tries to give you a little credibility here on a veterans program. Hopefully it's hosted by a veteran. How about that? Anyway, we want to welcome you to our program. We've got a great guest today, and hopefully we can get a hold of him here. His name is Dan Schilling, and he's written a book called Alone at Dawn. It's the story of Medal of Honor recipient John Chapman, and it's just a story that will drive you crazy to read it. It talks about John Chapman's childhood, the training that he went through. He was a command and controller in the Air Force. And we talked about the command and control people in the Air Force a couple of weeks ago in Hunting for the Caliphate. And these are things about the Air Force that I never knew. And I'm really pretty excited to be able to send this information and bring this news to you as an audience. So he will be on in just a little bit. I want to make sure that we talk about our sponsors just a little bit. We couldn't be here without them. Number one on the list would be Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans is a law firm specializing in veterans' disability claims. That's all that they do. So for more information, go to their website, legalhelpforveterans.com, or you can call them directly anytime at 800-693-4800, 800-693-4800. And U.S. Wings, the manufacturers of the finest leather flight jackets in the world. U.S. Wings is a major supplier of leather flight jackets to the military. And also, they are the ones that provide us with a jacket every month for our benefits program, which is coming up next week. So if you go to veteransradio.net, you'll see a big button there that says sign up to win the jacket. So go to our website and sign up and see if you can win the jacket. We've given away, I think, about six of them or so. They're beautiful. And this is your opportunity to win one. But for more information about U.S. Wings, you can go to their website. That's uswings.com. Or call them at 800-650-0659. 800-650-0659. And, of course, we would be very remiss if we didn't thank our local veteran service organizations, American Legion Post 46, VFW Post 423, and the Charles S. Kettles VVA Post 310, all of Ann Arbor, Michigan. Thank you all very much to all of our sponsors and supporters here. We couldn't do the program without you. Well, there's a whole lot of things going on in the next couple of weeks here as we approach Labor Day, and so I want to talk about a couple of them here today. Number one is the Moving Wall, and the Moving Wall is coming to Hamburg, Michigan. And for those of you that are not familiar with Hamburg, Michigan, it's small. It's a tiny little town, but they have worked very hard to schedule the wall. They've had the wall there before, and this is coming up on the week of August 29th through Labor Day, September 2nd. It's going to be located at where'd my notes go here? It's going to be at the Manly Bennett Park. That's on Merrill Road in Hamburg. It's 10405 Merrill Road, Hamburg, Michigan. For more information about that, you can go to the Moving Wall Hamburg with a U, .org. It's the Moving Wall Hamburg .org, and there's all their information is on there for you. This is a great opportunity for you not only to see the wall, but they've got demonstrations there. They've got a couple of different organizations. There's the Able Company and the Wolfhounds who bring all kinds of military paraphernalia out there, equipment and so forth, and they go through maneuvers. I think you'll find that really interesting. They're going to be offering Huey helicopter rides this year, and they also have a Bob Hope USO show tribute. So I would strongly suggest that you go to their website. Again, that's themovingwallhamburg.org. Mark it on your calendar, August 29th through September 2nd of 2019, and it's at Manly Park in Hamburg, Michigan. I think it's a great showing of support for veterans and for the military today. So do that. Go to the Moving Wall. All right. We've got a couple of other things here real quick. Number one is the Veteran Health Summit is coming up again. This is the, where did it go? They don't have the number on it now. I thought it was like the 10th annual, excuse me. Canton Community Foundation, together with Legal Help for Veterans, is presenting the 10th annual Veteran Health Summit 2019 on Wednesday, September 18th from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Schoolcraft College at the Vista Tech Center there on Haggerty Road. So mark that one on your calendar as well. That's a Veteran Health Summit at Schoolcraft College Vista Tech Center Wednesday, September 18th from 9 until 1 p.m. This is free to all military veterans, friends, family, and caregivers. The topics will be that you'll be able to hear about and find out more information about are maximizing your veterans' health care, disability update, health care in the community, the VA Center here in Ann Arbor, their update for them, and the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency update. All of this is free for you. You just need to register, please, and you can go to cantonfoundation.org. That's Canton, C-A-N-T-O-N, foundation.org, Wednesday, September 18th. And save the date of Friday, September 20th, too, because September 20th is National POW MIA Recognition Day. And there's a program going on Friday the 20th at 6:30 p.m. Presented by the POW Commission or Committee of Michigan in observance of National POW MIA Recognition Day at the Michigan Remembers POW MIA Memorial. It's in Oakland Hills Memorial Gardens on 12 Mile and Novi Road in Novi, Michigan. The keynote speaker is going to be former Air Force Lieutenant Rich Luderman, who just happens to be the chief meteorologist on Fox 2 Detroit. It's kind of cool. For more information on that, you can email, POWMIA, I better spell this one out for you. It says email POWMIAPINEAU. At outlook.com, or better yet, you can give them a call at 734-395-4697. And that is a National POW MIA Recognition Day, a special organization going on here in the state of Michigan, or a special commemoration of that. So let's see. We have a lot of things happening. Thank you very much. For those of you that are listening to Veterans Radio from other parts of the country, please send us your events and we'll be happy to announce them on our program. I know that now that we are broadcasting on stations in Pennsylvania and in California, that you can send us your information and we'll put it on our program for you out there. The last thing I wanted to bring up real quickly, the moving wall. Oh, two things. I'm sorry. Pig roast. The VBA, Charles S. Kettles Chapter 310, is sponsoring their annual pig roast on September 8th. That's a Sunday from 1200 to 1600 hours. That's from noon to 4 for anybody else who can understand military time, which is, once you've been in the military, you know, it seems like everything you do now is still related to 1200 hours, 1300 hours, and so forth. So anyway, this is from 1200 to 1600 hours on Sunday, September 8th. Come on out for their biggest fundraiser of the year. This is where we raise the funds for all of the different activities that we're involved with the VA hospital, food banks, Dawn Farms, everything else that we do to help veterans and their families. There's going to be music. There's food, pork, of course, since we are roasting a pig all night the night before. There's silent auction. There's a helicopter, tanks, trucks, all kinds of military vehicles out there, and all kinds of military paraphernalia. So come on out to the VVA's Charles Kettles 310 annual pig roast. It's being held at the VFW Hall on Wagner Road in Ann Arbor, Michigan on Sunday, September 8th from noon to 4. And then the final thing is that we're coming up here in 2 weeks to our second open mic for veterans. And the first one went really well, so we're very excited about this. So we want you to mark your calendar and join us on Wednesday, the 28th of August, 2018, and with the There I Was open mic for veterans on Wednesday from 6 until 8 or 1800 hours to 2000 hours at the VFW Post 423 again. That's at 3230 South Wagner Road. Our theme for this month's open mic night is basic training. Need I say more? So we'd like you to show up. Try to get there around 5:30 so you can sign in. And we want to hear your stories. This is a great opportunity for us to tell our stories to each other And we're going to find out that we have a lot more in common than we think. So come on out again. That's open mic night for veterans, Wednesday, the 28th of August, 2019, from 1800 to 2000 hours at the VFW Post 423. There I Was is going to be on the last Wednesday of every month, hopefully for a long time. So we'll hope to see you there. All right, so now we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Dan Schilling, who is the author of Alone at Dawn, the story of Medal of Honor recipient John Chapman. And he's also going to tell us about the incredible training that these command and controllers have to go through, better known as CCTs. So you're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back in just a moment.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
We're back on Veterans Radio, and joining me on the line here in just one moment after I read his amazing resume or curriculum vitae here is Dan Schilling, the author of Alone at Dawn, the story of the Medal of Honor recipient John Chapman. All right, so Dan Schilling spent more than 30 years in special operations, primarily as a combat controller and special tactics officer, but proudly started in the military as an infantry paratrooper. His numerous combat and clandestine deployments have taken him around the world, including Operation Gothic Serpent, more popularly known as Black Hawk Down from the movie and the book bearing the same name, where he was credited with saving the lives of a Ranger and SEAL, SEAL Team 6 SEAL, while under fire. He later founded and then served as the first commander of 2 Special Operations Squadrons, one of which whose names and purpose still remains classified. His military certifications include HALO, and Static Line Master Parachutist, Special Forces Combat Diver, and Demolitions Instructor. I'll skip some of these other things that you've done, Dan, because it's just amazing. But the one thing I want to really talk about is that he holds the Guinness World Record for base jumps, and I'll have to ask you what that is, in 24 hours, 201 jumps, a feat he conducted to benefit children who had lost a parent of special operations through the Special Operations Warrior Foundation. Dan is a full-time writer, and you can find out more about him by visiting his website, Dan Schilling Books. So, Dan, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Dale, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time and coming on the program. This book is just absolutely amazing, and it's something that I think the audience really needs to be aware of. It's a story of John Chapman, or Chappie, to his friends. And I guess we should start with how did you decide to write this book? I know there was a little bit of hesitance on your part initially.
Well, yeah, I spent 31 years in uniform in one service or another. And for me, I had retired to Utah, and my plan was to hang out with my wife because I'd missed her for many, many years, and write novels and ski and speed fly and the other things I do. So I got introduced to John's sister by a mutual friend of ours, and she'd been looking to write his biography for a long time, and I wasn't looking to go back and do that sort of story. I'd been through Black Hawk Down and the writing process there. But we met, and I realized, not only did I know John, I knew all the guys, the principal characters involved in this story, and the unknown story of John's community and my own community, which is combat control. And after a couple sleepless weeks, I called her back and said, listen, I gotta get into this project and do this, and spent 2.5 years writing it, and the results hopefully on your table.
It is. It's right here in front of me. And it's so tell me, you just mentioned this, and I want to remind our audience, tell me what a combat controller is.
So a combat controller is the Air Force's equivalent to a ground special operations operator, as you would have in the Navy, would be a SEAL. In the Army, it's mostly a Green Beret, could be a Ranger, and then there's some subsets of that. And this is the Air Force's version. What sets them apart from the others, because whether you're a Green Beret or a SEAL or a combat controller, we all have the same foundational skill sets, which is infiltration methods, like jumping out of planes, doing halo or scuba diving, you know, or going in by helicopter and shooting, moving, communicating, those sorts of things on the ground. And you build from there. But what separates them is their expertise in applying the lethality of air power in a battle. Because these guys are trained air traffic controllers to start with, something the Air Force takes very seriously, as you might imagine, and they hone that skill. And, you know, things that you can't, like an A-10 airstrike using 30-millimeter Gatling gun cannon in the front, you know, the standoff safety for that is 300 meters when you're doing that. I've got friends that are combat controllers that have called those airstrikes in 30 feet from their position. So that orchestration between the pilot and that guy on the ground is not resident in any other community but combat control to that level.
I was not surprised, I guess, when I first learned about what combat controllers did. But the idea of they control all the airspace and call in all the different types of, as you mentioned, platforms to a particular area, and they, you know, what kind of weapons that the airplane should have on them, what weapons they want to use, as you mentioned, you know, how close can they get and where the actual targets are, and they talk all about lasers and so forth, and we'll go into that in a little bit. But it's just interesting to me to learn about what the Air Force does, because you guys, no offense, but there's not a whole lot of publicity about this, and I'm sure that maybe they,
right.
They don't want a lot of publicity, but unfortunately, that's what we're going to do today.
Well, yeah, and it's, you know, it's funny because we've existed in the seams. Combat control predates SEALs or Green Berets. They've been around longer, and no one knows about them. But what's so amazing is the fact that they are the deadliest individuals to walk a battlefield in the history of human warfare. Period. There's no caveat to that. One of the passages I like to read when I do public readings or interviews and things or presentations is one of the first combat controller to go across the border into Afghanistan in America's response to 9/11 is a guy named Calvin Markham. And in his first 26 days in combat, he killed more Taliban and Al-Qaeda enemy combatants than any SEAL, Green Beret, or Ranger did in any career throughout their entire career. He killed 3,500 men in 3 weeks, and that was his first deployment. It's the ability to kill so many people who you should kill that separates them from everybody else, and it's a lot of responsibility for an individual to carry on their shoulders.
Was he involved with the Horse Soldiers, Doug Stanton's book?
Yeah, well, so yes. What's interesting is Doug Stanton's book is about Special Forces ODA, Operational Detachment Alpha, A-Team. Those are all synonyms. 595. That's the book, Horse Soldiers, and then the movie 12 Strong.
Right.
But two ODAs went across the border that night together. 595, which was Doug Stanton's book, and Triple Nickel. And one had a combat controller, the Triple Nickel, and this is Calvin Markham, the guy I was just talking about, and the other did not. And the difference between those two A-teams on the battlefield in their first 2 weeks of combat were night and day. In fact, Doug Stanton's ODA, in the book, they were refused any more aircraft because they could not apply the air power effectively. It was a decision by the Special Forces Commander, Colonel Mulholland, who said, "You're not getting any more bombers. I'm going to send you a combat controller, and then you can have more planes." And that's a true story. And that's not really what comes out in the book. So for me, in my book, it was a chance to use this as a case study. Mm-hmm. One's got one, one doesn't. What's the difference? Calvin Markham killed 3,500 men and saved an entire Northern Alliance battlefield all by himself, and the other ODA didn't have that.
Well, I want to talk more about that as we go along. But let's go back to the beginning where you start looking at the history of John Chapman. Tell me a little bit about him.
John was a really unique individual, even in our community, because he had an empathetic ability that just exceeds most people. As a 5-year-old, this is one of my favorite anecdotes. It comes from my co-author, which is John's sister. He at age 5, first day of kindergarten, everybody's first day of kindergarten, and here's this new kid in town, first day of school, first day in town, brand new kid, and he's getting bullied by this girl, because when you're 5 years old, girls can bully boys. And John sees this thing unfolding, doesn't know either kid, and he steps in and says, I don't think this should happen here. And he did that throughout his whole life. He just had this ability to stand up to bullies or protect people who were facing sort of, you know, those adverse situations. And it made him a remarkable individual and very competitive athlete in high school, popular kid, but he would still stand up for, you know, disadvantaged kids because he felt it was the right thing to do. And that's not something you can train people. You have that or you don't.
Right. In fact, later in the book, you talk about a memorial being built at his high school for him. And one of his classmates talks about how John really just kind of made this guy who was one of those people that stand in the background, and gave him the confidence that he needed to become a successful. I think he's a chef now.
Yeah, a world-renowned chef. And he just took the time to take this in high school. You know, in high school, most high school kids aren't going to buck the group, right? You social pressure to conform or to not stand out are really powerful, you know, forces that act on individuals, especially at that age. And John was just immune to that, really.
Mm-hmm. We're talking here with Dan Schilling. He's one of the authors of Alone at Dawn, a story of Medal of Honor recipient John Chapman here on Veterans Radio. Did John always want to be in the military?
No. He grew up in a New England town in Connecticut called Windsor Locks. And he was a very competitive diver in high school. In fact, he was the number one diver in the state for competitive diving, and was going to go to UConn, University of Connecticut, and he did. And like a lot of guys, and I sort of, this is not uncommon in our community, you go to college, you realize you're not ready for that, and he basically failed out, wasn't even eligible to dive in his second semester. So he went home, didn't know what to do, and worked, drove a tow truck, did some body work, and realized, you know, I need to leave town. I need to go do something with my life, and I think the military might be the answer. So he joined the Air Force, but not to be a combat controller, because he promised his mother he'd do something safe. So for 3 years, he was a communications guy in a radio, or in the Air Force. And during that time, he started to hear about combat control. A few things were coming to light, and he realized, hey, you know, this is something that would allow me to do, push myself past what most guys can do, and I really wanted to find that, where's that threshold for me? Where's my limits? And he started with 50 other guys, and this is one of those things about combat control, and I usually compare it directly to SEALs. The combat control special operations training pipeline, as we call it, is longer, more expensive, more intellectually demanding, and as physically challenging as becoming a SEAL. So John started with 50 guys, and a year plus later, there were two.
Two?
4% success rate. Two. Him and another guy. That's it.
Ooh, I thought flight school was bad.
My class was the same. I started with 150 guys, and a year and a half later, there were six. Same success rate. Same attrition rate, 94%.
So we've got about 3 minutes before we have to take a break. So the training, this is all prior to really all of the combat control training. Is it, was the physical training, you mentioned, similar to the SEALs or Rangers or Delta, same type of physical challenges there?
Yeah. You know, for us, it's all that training I'm talking about. It's about 2.5 years of straight training before you can go to a team and even be eligible to deploy for combat. And, I mean, it's just, if you enlist for 4 years, over half your enlistment is trying to get certified to go to war. You know, and everything's in there. Combat scuba diver, HALO school, static line, shooting, demolitions, air traffic control. All that stuff is in that entire pipeline.
That's a lot of training. I mean, and so much cross training that's involved. It sounds like when you're doing all those things. I had before we get to the break at the bottom of the hour, I wanted to ask you about this. What are base jumps that you did to raise money for the kids of Special Operations Warrior Foundation?
Base jumping is jumping with a parachute without an airplane. And it's called fixed object jumping in the sense that BASE is an acronym. It stands for building, antenna, span, which is the same as a bridge, mm-hmm. and earth. And those are the four objects you can jump off of the earth with a parachute and, you know, open your parachute. And so for me, you know, some guys to sort of compensate for, you know, PTSD or working through issues, drink. For me, I was sort of an adrenaline fueled guy.
Mm-hmm.
And, base jumping was a way to sort of push my limits. And for me to do a world record was a combination of something I felt very strongly about, kids who've lost a parent in special ops, and combining it with a sport that I was very passionate to do. I used to base jump most days of the week.
So this is like jumping off of radio towers and bridges?
Yeah,
and
antennas or buildings. I used to go to Las Vegas and jump buildings on occasion. I don't do that anymore. It's illegal.
I was going to say, you'd probably draw a crowd when you do that. I think so. All right, we got to take a break for the news, so please hang on. We're talking with Dan Schilling. He's the author of Alone at Dawn, the story of the Medal of Honor recipient John Chapman, whose adventures, I guess you could say, of earning the Medal of Honor were actually videotaped. You could see the fight on the Internet, and we'll talk about how you can do that later on. But we'll take a real quick break now. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Boatswain's Mate Second Class Owen Hammersburg worked for hours to rescue two fellow divers trapped underwater. Details after this. When two fellow divers were hopelessly trapped in a cave-in of steel wreckage of an LST sunk in 40 feet of water and 20 feet of mud in Pearl Harbor, Hammersburg unhesitatingly went overboard to effect their rescue despite the certain hazard of additional cave-ins and the risk of fouling his lifeline on jagged pieces of steel embedded in the shifting sand. He reached the first of the trapped men, freed him from the wreckage, and working desperately in pitch-black darkness, finally effected his release from fouled lines, enabling him to reach the surface. Wearied, but undaunted after several hours of arduous labor, Hammersburg continued his struggle to save the second diver. Venturing still farther under the buried hulk, he held tenaciously to his purpose, reaching a place immediately above the other man, just as another cave-in occurred. A piece of heavy steel pinned him crosswise over his shipmate in a position that protected the man beneath from further injury, while placing the full brunt of terrific pressure on himself. Although he succumbed in agony 18 hours after he had gone to the aid of his fellow divers, Hammersburg effectively saved the lives of his two comrades.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
We're back on Veterans Radio for the second half of today's program. We're talking with Dan Schilling, author of a book called Alone at Dawn, the story of Medal of Honor recipient John Chapman. We've talked a little bit about John's growing up in Connecticut and joining the Air Force and then finally getting into the combat control program, which took him a year and a half to get through. Dan, when was John first deployed? I know there was an issue that he had.
Well, that was his first deployment for combat,
mm-hmm.
And obviously his last. In fact, his first and last gunfight took place on the mountain that morning. So, you know, he missed the first Gulf War because he fell off a horse and ruptured his spleen while horseback riding with his fiance, then became his wife and the mother of his two children. So he was a guy really looking to try and get into combat, like many of us do. You know, if you join special ops, you want to go and get into the mix because that's what you're training for. It's what you've trained to do. And if you never do it, there's sort of a missing validation, I think, that we all feel. So for John, you know, he had this pretty long career already, three assignments, had assessed to the highest combat control squadron in the Department of Defense, which was the 24th Special Tactics Squadron. It's equivalent to SEAL Team 6 or Delta Force. And again, people don't know about that. Now, that's not even classified. That's what's so ironic. 24th Special Tactics Squadron is not classified. It's just hidden in plain sight. But that's where he had spent the rest of his operational career, and he was, you know, in his late 30s. And when the war came, he thought he'd missed it because he was on another, in another program doing some survey type operations. And he basically pushed to get onto a deployment with SEAL Team 6, the Red Team Sniper Element. And he knew these guys pretty well. And he finally got his shot. January 26th, he deployed. 6 weeks later, he had passed into history.
Now, why did he take the job with the surveying? That's, I thought that was rather interesting.
Well, it's, you know, the thing about combat control is you hone all these skills that are esoteric or specialized, and people, they're not really part of what you normally associate with special ops. So AutoCAD, you know, the computer program and these things that sort of come to you. And it was a program designed to survey places of interest to special operations, either now or in the future. And so he took that job to sort of slow the pace and spend more time at home with his wife and two daughters, who he was very close to. And for that reason, when the war came, all the other guys left, and guys doing these types of jobs didn't go in the first wave. And he feared he wasn't ever going to get to go to combat.
And so, yeah, but he finally did.
In
the book, which is a great read for military and civilians alike, I think that you'll find it really interesting. You know, you'll get lost in all the acronyms, but I think you'll eventually figure them all out, because you talk all about the missions that were leading up to John's final mission. And could you talk a little bit about the command and controllers and what the combat controllers and what they did in Afghanistan? Because they were there almost immediately.
Yeah, in fact, you know, before, as we were talking about horse soldiers earlier, those first two special forces, ODAs, one with a controller and one without, there was already a combat controller in country who'd gone in with the CIA and paramilitary guys, you know, and that's the thing that's great about being combat controllers. You work with the best of everybody. You're attached to a SEAL platoon. You're detailed to the CIA. You're with the Australian SAS. You're with Delta Force if you've gone to the 2-4. Mm-hmm. I mean, you work with the best from around the world. And, you know, so we had guys peppered in the battlefield. And when Operation Anaconda, early in the war, this is February of 2002, started to be planned by the regular Army. It was a big 101st Airborne operation. They were going to, you know, drive the Taliban against the mountain and crush them using air power. There were combat controllers sprinkled throughout. But for John, who had now deployed, he got the job working for a Delta Force officer named Pete Blaber. And Pete Blaber was running teams from SEAL Team 6 and Delta Force with combat controllers attached to them behind enemy lines to call in those airstrikes. So really, the guys who were going to kill the bad guys weren't Delta Force or SEAL Team 6. It's the attached combat controllers. And John was one of them.
You mentioned in the book, again, trying to get people to understand what an interesting read this is, about inter-service, I almost want to say jealousy a little bit, here of, you know, some people didn't think that you mentioned earlier about the combat controllers were not needed, and you know, SEALs could do it on their own. They didn't, you know, or whoever it might be. But that even all the way up the chain, there were some questions about the effectiveness of what a combat controller can do.
Yeah, a lot of it comes down to learning curve. And because combat control has always existed in the seams and invisibility, and it's part of what my book is about. My book is here to rectify that. I want Americans to know the deadliest guys to walk a battlefield in the history of human warfare aren't SEALs or Green Berets or anybody from a foreign country. They're in the Air Force, and people should know that. As you said, it's an American book. It's not for a military reader. I wrote it for Americans. And in the leading up to this battle, you know, both Special Forces ODAs, 595, the horse soldier guys, and Triple Nickel, were offered combat controllers. One refused and one didn't, because one recognized the value and the other didn't. Mm-hmm. And so it's this continual education process that has to happen for people to know. Uday and Hussein, Kisei Hussein, Saddam Hussein's two sons, who deserved to die terrible deaths.
Mm-hmm.
People think they were killed by Delta Force. They weren't. They were killed by an attached combat controller named Aaron. And when you talk about the SEAL Team 6 rescue of Captain Phillips off the coast of Somalia, you know, and the SEAL snipers killed the Somali pirates and rescued Captain Phillips, one of those guys wasn't a SEAL. He was a combat controller. Americans don't know that. They're embedded everywhere, and that's my mission.
That's what it sounds like. It sounds like that every special ops unit needs to have a combat controller with them. And it sounds
if they're
like,
smart.
If they're, yes. And it sounds like even though they go through very similar training, their specialty is not necessarily on the ground. I mean, they can do it, obviously, and you know, they can fight one-on-one and so on and so forth. But the idea is that their specialty is to bring in the air power and, you know, to wipe out the bad guys wherever they can.
Yeah, that's correct. But what's important for people not to misunderstand is their ability to infiltrate like a SEAL or a Green Beret and operate on the ground is the same. They are just as good as those guys. I'm not saying they're better at shooting, moving, and communicating.
Fine.
Yeah, no,
I wasn't trying to
I just like to clarify that. Yeah, yeah, no, I know you weren't, but for me, I usually emphasize that because sometimes people will misunderstand what I'm saying. It's not to take anything away from SEALs or Green Berets. It's the fact that, and they can call in airstrikes. You know, they can get that certification. What they don't have is the expertise to do it to the level that's demanded in a modern battlefield when you can't have collateral damage.
Right. Yes. You're so afraid of, you know, of killing civilians and or, you know, anything like that, that their rules of engagement are so much tighter than they've ever been, I think, probably in the history of war.
Ever. You know, firebombing Dresden or Tokyo is never going to happen in warfare again, not like we've seen. And these combat controllers, here's the thing. When you're on a team and Aaron, the guy I talked about, and they kill Saddam Hussein's terrible kids, we all win as a team. But if that guy fails and calls in an airstrike and kills his friends, he's going to carry that burden alone. And they are almost always the lowest ranking guy on a team. But you carry more weight than any of the SEALs or Green Berets you're working with because you've got all this comm gear that is your life and death, literally. And so it's a disproportionate burden for an individual, and you're attached to these guys, and it's difficult, man.
I was just going to ask that question about the average weight of everything that they carry because, again, I mean, you're talking about, you know, rucking it with a, you know, 120 pounds or something. It sounds
yes.
like with all the lasers and batteries and radios and antennas and everything else that they have to carry in addition to their weapons.
Yeah, and the same stuff that everybody else is carrying. And the thing about being this, and now you're this Air Force guy, and it's a thing. It's a dynamic you're acutely aware of. If you ask for help to carry weight, it's like, oh, the Air Force guy can't carry his weight. As a byproduct of that dynamic, combat controllers always go into the combat, behind enemy lines, in an assault, it doesn't matter, carrying more weight than the guys that they're with, and the responsibility to get it all right, or they're going to hang you with it.
Mm-hmm.
Man, that is an amazing responsibility, and that's why they're trained so extensively, and that's why our attrition is so high. It has to be.
Sure.
You can't have the mistake on the battlefield.
No.
You know, and John was one of those guys.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the day. All right, we got about 15, 16 minutes left here. So
okay.
Let's go to March 4th of 2002. What was going on?
Well, so for John and six SEALs are going to go behind enemy lines. They've been pushed into this gunfight by SEAL Team 6 headquarters against the wishes of the ground commander, which was a Delta Force officer, because they wanted more guys in the fight. A legitimate sort of thing to do, but they were making poor choices because they forced these guys to go up on top of this mountain and insert right on their observation post, which you would never do behind enemy lines. But it happened. While they're inserting, because of some of the confusion and how this was coordinated, they came under fire at the summit of this mountain, Kakargar Mountain. It's about 10,500-foot mountain. It's March in Afghanistan, knee-deep in thigh-deep snow. It's wicked cold, and it's in the middle of the night. When they took fire, a SEAL named Neil Roberts, who wasn't snapped in, fell out of the back of the helicopter. a helicopter got shot down and limped off into the night thanks to some great piloting skills. The pilot manages to land it upright. And now here's John Chapman with five remaining SEALs. What are you going to do? You have to go back, right?
Mm-hmm.
You don't really have a choice. You have a choice, but it's not really a choice, not for guys like us.
No, you got to get
it. You got to go back. Doesn't matter how the fact that there was 24 enemy guys on that mountain and now we're only 6 dudes instead of 7. They get in another helicopter and they go back. They insert, Neil Roberts had already been executed, captured and killed, but they didn't know this. And when they land on the mountain, that helicopter too takes heavy fire, but the guys come out the back. John Chapman on his own without any direction, recognizing the most dire threat. They're getting strafed and fired up from four different directions, charges uphill in the snow with all his weight into an enemy bunker and kills Al-Qaeda fighters. They weren't Taliban. Mm-hmm. At point-blank range, 10 feet, and saves all the SEALs' lives, which is what the SEALs all stated. I've got their witness statements.
Mm-hmm.
In the process, John got shot in the torso twice, mortally wounded. And the SEALs, now down to just 5 guys on this team from an original 7, make the decision to retreat. And they thought John was dead, but they didn't check him, and he wasn't. It just happened. No one's, as a guy, right. I've been in some pretty big gunfights. I'm not saying what they did was right. I'm not saying what they did was wrong. I'm saying it happened, and you can't armchair quarterback that. But they left the man for dead who wasn't. That's the fact. Well, after the SEALs retreated, John recovered and found himself alone on this mountain with 24 Chechen and Uzbek fighters trying to displace him. And he held them at bay single-handedly while in severe shock and severe blood loss. He's dying for an hour. It's remarkable.
An hour?
Well, yes. So he actually qualified for the Medal of Honor by saving the SEALs' lives. That was validated by U.S. Special Operations Command and JSOC and everybody else. What's remarkable about John, two things I think are really of value to listeners, is that now, after the sun has come up, John, who's been shot probably 10 times at this point, ultimately I know he got shot and received shrapnel penetrating wounds 16 times and survived 3 hand-to-hand combat engagements. Again, mortally wounded. He hears a helicopter coming up the mountain. Only one place it's going to be going, and that's Taker Gar. This man, who is in the process of dying, makes this decision to climb out of a bunker on his own and aggressively attack the enemy to protect 18 men he'd never even met. In the process, that qualifies him for a second Medal of Honor, but he got shot through the heart and perished after the guys safely landed on the mountain.
Hmm.
It's remarkable. Now, the other fact I wanted to share, second medal was one thing I wanted to point out. This is the only Medal of Honor ever witnessed by a video by the CIA Predator drone footage and also the AC-130 gunship footage overhead of an individual earning the Medal of Honor on video. And that's the video you were alluding to, Dale. If you go to YouTube or just Google first Medal of Honor, you should populate a video I created using that actual footage that I narrate. And it's very moving. That's an emotional video, at least to me. I think it's hard for people to watch without getting emotional.
Oh,
and
so.
Watching this man earn this medal.
Where do we go for that again?
It's on a YouTube channel, but if you just hit Google and Google first Medal of Honor, you'll come. It's 8 minutes and 50 seconds long. You'll see it because it's black and white footage and it's got some, overlays on it that, we created to make it easier for people to follow this sort of grainy black and white footage.
Is it spelled out first or the number one?
Spelled out first. If you just type in first Medal of Honor with the word first, you should populate.
All right. So, and this was, as you mentioned, this was recorded by the two aircraft that were up there.
And that became key to John's Medal of Honor investigation because for quite a long time, certain parties within SEAL Team 6 continued to maintain that John was dead when we actually knew he wasn't because he was calling out on the radio. First and foremost, he was alive because he was making radio transmissions after the SEALs retreated. We know this because 3 kilometers away on another hill,
was a teammate combat controller of his named Jay Hill, coincidentally, who was with Delta Force, and he heard John calling out, and he kept responding for reasons we'll never know. John never responded to Jay Hill's replies, but he made this call at least 15 times. But then there's all the other, the fact that he had 16 antemortem wounds, and we have him on the video, and it's definitely an American fighting, and these guys were watching John fight from 3 kilometers away. The SEALs had retreated. They didn't have any visibility. They were gone.
Yeah, it said Delta Force had slid down the mountain quite a ways.
Yeah, straight down the mountain. It was so steep. When you watch this video, you'll see them literally sliding down the face.
I am watching this right now. I'm trying to divide my attention. This is stunning.
Watch it. When we get done, for sure watch it, Dale. And if it doesn't emotionally affect you, I'll be stunned.
You will.
And it's gone viral. It's been around the world 5 times. It's got 5 million views. And we get comments. I've got an assistant who tracks these, and we get comments from Russia, Korea, India, everywhere, all over the place.
All right. So let's go back to, you know, John was killed, as you mentioned, numerous wounds. How did they get? Did they finally get him off the mountain?
Well, so, you know, 7 men ultimately died on that mountaintop. The first was Neil Roberts, the SEAL. The second was John. But at the time, 3 Rangers died. Another Air Force pararescueman named Jason Cunningham died. He bled out. We couldn't get him off the mountain in time. And then a crewman from the best helicopter pilots in the world, aerial helicopter crews in the world, the Task Force 160th. So, but the Rangers, with another combat controller and an Air Force TACP and another PJ, did take the summit. That's what Rangers do better than anybody. Mm-hmm. They're shock troops, man. They can assault anything. And they killed off the enemy, which were now hundreds, a couple hundred enemy combatants converging on this mountain. Mostly held at bay and killed by the next combat controller, Gabe Brown. But the Rangers won the gunfight, and they then occupied the summit. Well, they evacuated all the troops. That's when they discovered that, hey, there's another American up here we didn't even know. Because the SEALs called in for rescue. No one knew John was on the mountain at the time or understood the situation. And then they recovered his body, and they evacuated everybody that night. Mm-hmm. What's another fact that's really interesting about this gunfight is, of the 25 Americans on the top of this mountain in the morning of March 4th, 18 would earn a Silver Star or above, making it, I believe, the most valorous, proportionally valorous battle in the history of American warfare.
Wow. We're talking with Dan Schilling here, the author of the book Alone at Dawn. It's the story of Medal of Honor recipient John Chapman. And the story doesn't end there, because he didn't get the Medal of Honor right away, did he?
No. It's not a big part of the book, but it's a big part of John's journey. Was, you know, from March of 2002 to August of 2018, you know, 16 years and some change, it took for that medal to make its way to the White House and be awarded to his widow. And that's part of the story. There's a lot of reasons why that goes into, and we probably couldn't cover it all in this, but it's in the book, at least in the important parts are. And there was some controversy here and there, but that's the way those things go.
Well, we know that we have a local Medal of Honor recipient who received it for action in the Vietnam War, and he just got it 3 years ago. So they had to spend all that time upgrading his Distinguished Service Cross.
Yeah, and John's was the same way, because Distinguished Service Cross, of course, is the Army Service Cross. The Navy Cross is the Navy Cross, and the Air Force is the Air Force Cross. And John received the Air Force Cross very early on. It was October of 2002 that he received that, which is a huge honor. But when you really dug into this thing, those of us who really looked into it, and I spent 2.5 years chronicling this and putting together my own investigation with the support of the Air Force and DOD in my research, it just became this remarkable story. I mean, this guy, to make the decision to climb out of this bunker, he was close to death already, so much blood loss and so much tissue damage from the gunshot and shrapnel wounds, to climb out of that bunker, realizing if I just stay in this bunker, I might make it out of this thing. If I climb out of this bunker, I can't say what he thought, but I can say he decided this.
Right.
He had to know he was going to die. Mm-hmm. But he already was dying. He wasn't going to survive no matter what. That's amazing to me, as a guy who's been in gunfights, that he could make that decision and muster the fortitude to do it, physically even, let alone emotionally.
And considering what a committed family man he was, and had become, and I was looking at the pictures again. I really encourage people to get a hold of this book. There's so many things that we just don't understand because we've never been to Afghanistan, and so we don't know anything about the terrain or anything else really. But there's this really just really emotional picture of John with a little Afghan girl.
Oh, if we have a couple minutes, I'll tell you that story because it's a testament to who John was.
Yeah, we've got about that, 4 minutes.
Perfect, no problem. I'll give you two, and then take two, and then you can ask a couple closing questions. This is a couple weeks before John died. They are in an Afghan village hunting Mullah Omar, and a snowstorm descends on the Afghan mountains as it does in the wintertime, and they basically storm this house. And when I tell audiences, when I talk, it's like, okay, if you're an American mother, it's like having 15 Afghan guys with beards and weapons storm your house and say, we're going to be staying here for the next 3 days, and they smell bad. How likely are you to put your 2-year-old daughter in the lap of one of those guys? The answer is you're not. But this is what happened. John and the SEALs were in this home, subsistence living, and he just radiated. You can see it in this photo you're talking about, and I encourage people to buy the book, obviously, but this photo, his the kindness in his eyes, he radiated this. And this mother put her daughter in his lap, and one of the SEALs snapped a photo, and it's become the iconic photo of his life. Because, I don't know how many Afghan villages you've hung out in, but mothers don't put their babies into American bearded operators' laps. Mm-hmm. And she did. And that's a testament to who he was as a character.
That's for sure. She must have seen something in his eyes that were, that she could trust him.
And you can see it too in the photo. Yeah. It's in the photo. Mm-hmm. That's what's so remarkable. I wanted it for the cover. I lost that battle with the publisher, and that's okay.
Yeah, that's all right. You won most everything else, it looks like, with the publisher.
It's worked out. We was 4 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. I'm so pleased with that because I want every American and I want every member of the U.S. Air Force to read this book because they don't take pride in their service the same way other services do often. The Air Force sort of gets relegated to second-class citizenship, and it's baloney. They're the deadliest individuals to walk a battlefield are in the Air Force.
Well, I think we all have this image of the Air Force as being, jet planes. And that's
and it is.
And that's about it. You don't think about how these jet planes go to their targets or who is actually on the ground. I ran into a gentleman. I worked with some special forces when I was in Vietnam. And I ran into a guy about 10 years ago or something. And he was doing the same mission with the Air Force that I was doing. I said, you were? I said, I didn't know the Air Force did that. And he goes, oh, let me tell you about it. So he did.
And that's the problem. And so, but people don't have any problem. When I ask audiences, I say, when I say U.S. Navy, what's the first thing that comes to mind? And people say ships and SEALs every single time. Well, what the Air Force needs to do, and this is my mission, I'm here to change the American view of the entire U.S. Air Force with a book so that they say planes and combat controllers, because that's a direct analogy.
Oh, and I totally agree, John. I think Dan, I think this is such an important book, and we just did a book a couple of weeks ago on the hunting for the caliphate, where I was introduced to combat control. So, anyway, the book is Alone at Dawn. The author is Dan Schilling, S-C-H-I-L-L-I-N-G. You can probably get it anywhere that you want, or you can go to his website, right?
Yep. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Dan, very much for being on Veterans Radio. All right, folks, we're going to wrap it up here again. How much time have I got? I'm down to, we got to go. Next week is a benefits program, so make sure you tune in for that one. Until then, you are dismissed.